Good afternoon. I'm Steve Adams, Microsoft's The Device Guy. And thanks to these two gentlemen, you can find me on Twitter at @MSDeviceGuy. As one of Microsoft's ambassadors, I want to take a moment and thank you personally for joining us this week at Ignite. I'm also an Atlanta resident, so welcome to my hometown as well, and I hope it's treating you well. I just want to take a few minutes to say thank you. Yesterday, Yusuf shared a really amazing number with us, 400 million users of Windows 10. And partly, I have to thank everyone in this room, so a round of applause for everybody. Come on, join me. Yay, us. For those that didn't clap, come on, get Windows 10. I do like to make a little joke, though. You know, 400 million is a great number, especially when it's free or was free. So thank you for those of us, for those that participated in Insider. Second thing, Microsoft is laser focused on Windows 10 deployment this year. The next 9 months, we have headcount in the field. We have investments we're making with partners, and we have investments we're making directly with our customers in making sure you have the tools and resources and information you need to drive Windows 10 deployment. Last year, we focused on the pilot proof of concept stage. This year is all about moving to production. So do not hesitate to reach out to your Microsoft folks that you deal with in your area and ask them, hey, what can you do to help me move to Windows 10? That's all I have. I did want to say one word about our fabulous presenters today. So I did go out on the internet trying to steal someone else's humor. And I said, okay, I typed in my Bing search. I said, two Swedes go to a technical convention. Well, come to find out there are very few technical Swede jokes out there, and I'm not creative enough to make it up. So I just want to, without further ado, if you haven't spent time with John and Michael, you're in for a treat. Gentlemen, take it away.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Yes, just a small group of friends gathered, 1,700 of us in this room. 752 was the assigned number for the session, and it looks pretty packed as far as I can see. We have these beamers in our heads also, so it's kind of hard to see the very last rows.
There is space in the corner in the right back, though.
Yeah, row 45.
Yeah, nobody wants to sit there. I have no idea why.
My name is Johan. This is Michael. We will be your hosts for the next 70-some minutes, and we will focus on customizing, stretching the limits, what you can do in terms of Windows 10 deployments using Config Manager or also happens to be Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. Just because we demo something in one of the other platforms, it's typically the way that you can actually do it on both. So we'll do most of the demos in Config Manager, but there are some MBT stuff as well in there.
Yeah. Next slide?
Yes.
So we have slides.
Yes, a few.
A few. We do assume that you know what operating system deployment is all about, and that means either Microsoft Deployment Toolkit or Configuration Manager. That's it with that slide.
Next slide.
So we're going to start talking about custom settings.ini. And custom settings.ini, this is a sample of it. It's a text file that we can use when we deploy operating system to control the behavior of the deployment. A lot of times I meet customers and they say, we had a hard time doing this, but we found a way. We created the following scripts. And just look at the sad face when you do the same thing with one line of text in a text file and go like, yeah, what you spent 2 weeks on, you can do in one line. Oh, I didn't know that. And that's true. Unless you know exactly how it works, well, then you do other things. But I think it's demo time.
It is, indeed.
And that means...
Seven, I think it's you.
No, I think it's eight. Might... No?
I seven? Think it's seven.
It's not seven. Could be nine. I'm nine and you're eight.
Okay.
I'm older than you.
Yes, you are.
In many ways. custom settings.ini is not that really complicated. Here's a bunch of sample files, but let's start with something reasonable, simple. Yeah, we can do that one. So custom settings.ini is read by a component called CTI gather. It gathers information on the machine, and then it converts everything it gathers into properties with variables. And then it uses that to process the file. So in this case, we specify settings. We specify the priority of model and default. So that means it's going to run the whatever model you have. It's just going to be a string search. So if it's a virtual machine, then it's going to flip to OS install yes. If it's and so on and so on. And the last section will be the default section. In this case, it's going to set the name of the computer to PC dash the leftmost 12 characters from the serial number and use that as a name. Now, the purpose of using custom settings.ini is to automate as much as possible. We still see a lot of customers naming computers, for instance, based on location, type, temperature, fan speed, and all kinds of and then you have a really nice name. The computer name is PC-FRBRGRDRNT8. And for whomever is working there, that makes sense. But the problem with that kind of name is that you then now need to translate that into an asset if you need to have service and support. So we try to automate as much as possible and do that. Some of you might say, well, I can do this in the task sequence. It's true, you can, both in Lightouch and Configuration Manager. You can do everything I'm doing right now. It's possible to do in a task sequence. How many times have you been to a customer, Johan, where they have more than two task sequences?
I've seen a few.
Have you seen the number of 40 or 50?
That too.
Hundreds?
No.
No. But in 40 and 50 sequences. And that is what we see. And now the downside of putting everything in the task sequence is that it takes time to verify that it's correct. I do have a customer in Switzerland, and the average time it takes for them to create an updated task sequence is 3 months. Because it takes approximately a month to verify that it works. And then they also have paperwork. And they also have about 30 task sequences. I spent a week with them. When I left, they had two sequences. And now the change process of doing an update is less than a week. That means they can do other things, like playing World of Tanks or whatever they want to do, which is kind of nice.
As you do.
As I do. So one of the really cool things is that you can verify that it works by just running the CTI gather WSF against an ini file and verify that everything works. So in this case, it's a text file that defines the computer name based on location and such things. So in this case...
And yes, these files are
available for download. Yes. That's true. Let's see. Using the command line.
Is it difficult for you?
No, not really. Just trying to find the... Host name was here. Let's open that file. Need to verify that type of location. Yeah.
Did you clean out the mini-enter folder?
I think I did. If I didn't, will you kill me for that?
No, I have a PowerShell script that automatically deletes it before it runs.
Yes. And that's why you should use the PowerShell script instead of doing what I do now. Because it cleans out that folder. So in this case, the computer name turns out to be WLT8T and numbers. We also can see that this assigned the following applications. Packages 001 and 002, and together with the computer name, and everything was retrieved from the custom settings.ini file. Now, if you do the same thing in the task sequence, it's going to work. It's just it's going to take an hour to verify that, if you do it correctly the first time. I'm not really into that. I tried to do it wrong a couple of times before I finally get it. Maybe it's just me, but That's how I do it. So if we go to CS demo, here it is, samples, type of location. It looks like this. So it's going to grab model default gateway by laptop type, desktop type by VM type. It's going to add custom properties, my name by type and name by location. And the default section is going to add the following name to it, just that the name is based on other variables that we retrieve from the default gateway, because we run default gateway first. And if it happens to be the following subnet, well, then we are in Atlanta, and therefore the name should be AT. We also checked laptop type and desktop type and VM type. And I've seen this happen a couple of times. By laptop type and by desktop type and by VM type, and then the customer calls me and say, hey, it doesn't work. It works for laptops, it works for desktop, but it doesn't work for VMs, because VMs is going to get the desktop name. True, because the virtual machine is actually detected as a desktop. And therefore, to make this work, you actually need to change this. So I'm going to move that to here. And now we change the order of the priority and how that works. And then it's going to build the name based on laptop, desktop, and VM, and add the following names to it. And finally, it's going to give that name. Now, I don't like this, but this was a customer that asked me to say, hey, we really need to have a name based on location, type of computer, and stuff like that. I prefer to have it another way. I'm not going to say that. I would like to keep it bad, in bad shape. If you want to download all these sample files, you can go to a site called deploymentbunny.com, and you search for custom-settings.ini, and it's going to give you a bunch of different links, and you can download it. Them and play with them on your own. Now, you can do things fully automated, since you can do custom settings.ini automated. So in this case, I have a build lab. And both the owner and me use Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and LightTouch to create reference images. Now, creating reference images is it's like watching paint dry. Or grass grow or something like that. Some people say it's fun. I'm not really sure what they do. But here we have settings, and then we have a section here that loads the KVP components in Windows PE, which you can't. But by modifying some VB scripts and create a service that is fake, then you can create that fake service, and then you can load the components, which means I can read the virtual machine name from within Windows PE. Now I can set that VM name, and then I can combine this and say, hey, the OSD computer name is basically the same thing. So now the virtual machine name will be the same name as the virtual machine has been named. And then you can set the task sequence ID to the same thing, which means that if you create a machine called PC001, it's going to look for a task sequence named PC001. But if I create it called ref W10, something like that, then it's going to create that as well. So if I have that, and I use PowerShell. I'm going to zoom this in a bit. I can then grab all the information from an XML file. Here is the name of the hypervisor, number of concurrent running virtual machines, things like that. And then we can read that. And we can read that. And then we can verify that we have access, and we can connect to MDT using PowerShell, and we can get all the properties from MDT using PowerShell, and then we can update the boot image, but I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to verify that I do have access to it, and then we can get to every task sequence we have from LightTouch, and it found one task sequence. So the end of the thing we need to do now is this. I basically have a PowerShell script that builds the VM, boots on an ISO, runs the creation of the reference image, sysprep capture, turns it off, builds the next one, next one, next one, until it's finished, then it removes everything and sends me an email.
So the shortened version of that entire walkthrough is that on the Deployment Bunny blog, you can download this, it's called Image Factory. What it will do is that when you run it in your environment, it will build one WIM file for each sequence that you have in your MBT deployment chair. So we typically have one Windows 7, one Windows 10, one server new, one server old, and then you run the script and it will build four WIM files. And you can schedule that, you can run that as often as you like, but the process is fully automated. This is it.
So it's LightTouch together with PowerShell together with custom-settings.ini. So you can automate a lot of things. I think number five is the presentation computer.
Yes.
Yes, it was. Now, sometimes custom-settings.ini doesn't...
It's not enough.
It's not enough.
One of the coolest things I like with both MDT and Config Manager is the ability you guys have to extend it. You can basically do anything you like with it. And one thing that we use for, I wouldn't say every project, but close to every single deployment project, is to add additional logic in terms of determining, figuring out what hardware we have. Because vendors, for the past 20 years, they have been using model as a good way of identifying a specific type of computers. And then we have other vendors, like Lenovo, who doesn't use model. Instead, they use model. That's basically their serial number. They use a machine type where the first four characters is identified as the actual model. But I can use the user exit script to normalize names. So even if you have a vendor that, in my opinion, doesn't follow the same standard as I want them to do, I can add logic to Config Manager that does that for me. So, good example. If I can have number 8 then.
Since you're younger than me.
Yes. Didn't you turn 50 recently?
We don't need to talk about that now.
Okay. If you want to call something else, in this case a script, you simply need to add that to the init file. You create another section and you say, run this script, thank you. And in this case, each of the functions that I have in that script is simply returning a value. In this case, a normalized value of the vendor, the make, and a normalized value of the model. All the logic is in the script. So if I open one of my example scripts, I have a few versions of this, again, available for download. Let's open it with something shiny. This is shiny.
Yes.
So here, for example, I have some normalization for vendor names. And as you can see, if it's a Dell something, it just spits back Dell. If it's any of these, it spits back to the Lenovo. And since HP never seemed to be consistent in what they call the machines, I simply check that it's any of these, I spit back HP. And same goes for models. I can say that if, for example, I'm using, I'm deploying Lenovo's. I'm not going to ask the normal WMI class for the model name. Instead, I'm going to ask system product. Because in the Lenovo case, it will give me a better name. Classic example. Did not mean to do that. The normal model name for a ThinkPad 420, an old machine, is something like this. That's a model name. And if you work with Lenovo, you know this is a ThinkPad P420. But if I use this user exit script instead, what it's going to speak back is, if I can type it correctly, the real name, as I like it. So basically, I simply have a script I add it to my deployment share, I add it to my config manager MDT package, the scripts folder, and then I modify my settings package with a few lines of text, and now I have added additional functionality into the platform. I can verify this, like Michael showed you. I like to do it in PowerShell, though, but it's fine to do it in Command Prompt also. I have a few PowerShell scripts. Doesn't find same trace, but that is fine. Let me see what the script I actually called. Wrong script. What can possibly go wrong in a live demo? How about I actually run the right script? What do you say?
Seems like a good idea. Now, some of you will argue and say, hey, I can do that by, in the task sequence, do a WMI query. I can do a WMI query in the
sure.
task sequence.
You can do that.
Yes.
But now you take all the logic and just add it to a function that you just add to your server. And you see it spits back model alias rather than model. So I do this instead of having to do this. Instead of having to know that a Lenovo uses this WMI class and a Panasonic using this WMI class, all that logic is in that script, and all I need to do is call it. So,
and here's another takeaway, because if you do it in the task sequence, you can only use it in the task sequence. So that means that you need to query again and again and again for the version or whatever it is. Instead of doing that, you query once, and then you can reuse that property in the sequence as well as in custom settings.ini.
Or any other script.
Yeah.
So when I start to add my packages, when I add my driver packages in my sequence, you typically have like 15 of them, I go to options, and instead of doing this complex query, I start Sumit also for the people in the cheap seats in the room. Sumit is this hack. So I remove the condition and say, instead, use a sequence variable. Model alias equals whatever the value was. In this case, it was CBook. Which would probably be stupid for 8560 driver package, but
slightly.
You get the idea. You simplify the book. You simplify the way you can work with conditions. And the same goes for driver applications. And you typically have many models there. You may have a hotkeys app, something.
It could also be that you have three different models of an HP, but it turns out that there's a CAB file for all three models. So then you can normalize all these three models into your own model and say, hey, this driver package go to this model name that I have, the HP Super Duper Computer version 4, and then you deploy that. So that's true.
Yep. So user exit script is just a convenient way of add additional functionality into the rules engine, and then your sequences can just consume that and use it.
So here's a question. If anyone wants to say, if the fan speed of the local fan on the machine is below a certain number of rotations per minute, then you should have Office installed, otherwise not. Is that possible?
Yes.
Don't do that. But you can.
See, people taking notes.
Fan speed Office, yes. 4,500, then it's yes, otherwise it's no, let's don't do that. But it can.
Yes.
So that was user exit and
not me.
I'm not doing anything. So then we have the MDT database. The MDT database is meant for storage data. That is supposed to be used when you deploy machines. That means that we now have one single instance to put all the data we want to, and then we can use that information to grab whatever we want during the deployment process. Now, it's just a SQL database, and it's either a SQL Express or a real SQL. It doesn't matter. I think we had a question a couple of times, do I really need to have a huge SQL? No, I need about a file size of 4 megs or something like that.
It's a very small database.
Yes.
It rarely grows beyond a few hundred, even in large environments.
We can also have stored procedures, which is kind of fun, because a stored procedure means that we can, from custom-settings.ini, call that stored procedure, meaning we have an offloading mechanism. I need you to do something on the server side, but I don't want you to be a domain admin or a database admin or whatever I want to want, whatever you need to be, so you can offload it. And
we typically use this to generate computer names, where you have like a prefix and then a sequence number, and we just use the database to keep track of all the names and numbers we already handed out.
And you can also extend the database with your own variables or your own values. One interesting thing is that Michael Niehaus, the distinguished godfather around MDT, a long time ago created a PowerShell function for accessing the database using PowerShell. And that we are going to look at. So it's demo time again.
Number nine.
It's still running. I need the reference image anyway, so. Okay. So let's go to the MDT server and let's zoom in. Not there, but there. First, we need to close that one. So the database is here, and the only thing you do is that you specify a new database, you specify the SQL Server named instance. There's two kinds of network libraries. You should use name pipes for authentication purposes, but that's pretty much the only thing you do. Once you've done that...
Well, why on earth are you using a protocol that was new when you were a kid?
That's a long time ago. Because Windows PE cannot authenticate against a SQL database correctly. It doesn't have that ability. The only way it can authenticate correctly is using name pipes. So it can do
an username password thing.
Yes, it can use a net use. So it will be possible for the Windows PE boot image to do a net use against a file share. Well, if I have a net use, then I'm already connected. And what we're actually telling the system to do is to use a trusted connection. So whatever you was authenticated with, use that connection again. And that is why you need to explain for the database administrator on the big SQL cluster to create a file share. I have been in those discussions, and they go like, you want me to create a file share on the SQL cluster?
Yes. Please.
Why? Well, we need to have one. Uh-huh. What should it contain? Nothing. You want me to create an empty file share on the SQL cluster? Yes, please. Are you insane? No. So it's much, much easier to be your own DBA and run your database on your own.
Well, that's why you should have SQL local. We talked about this. Yes.
So then I can add all my computers, and it's not really complicated. You just type in the values for instance, for the MAC address, if you have a MAC address. Oh, I have a MAC address here. And you specify if you want to do recognition on asset tags, GUID number, serial number, and then you fill out the details. And when you show this for customers, they go like, really, is that the way we're going to work? Well, yeah. This is like working in the registry directly. There are other ways, of course, and one way is this. You can use PowerShell. So if I zoom that a bit, I have a PowerShell script that has the ability to add a computer. You specify the computer name, you specify the role, and you specify the MAC address. Let's run that script and add it to the database. And it says warning. And that's because that MAC address already exists. Now I have a switch called force, which means it's going to override it anyway. Now if you go back to the database, it's not here. But you can refresh this. So you refresh this, and it's not here.
The shortcut is also F5, so you can press F5 many, 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 many times.
Yes, but if you select the database and you do a refresh, and then magically it appears. So now I use PowerShell to add this. Is it possible to use other methods besides PowerShell to add things to a SQL database? No, you're absolutely right. There's no way besides using PowerShell or this UI. Of course, you can do whatever you like. So we added a machine, and that also means that if I go to this machine, which is this machine, and I import that registry value, sorry, that DLL, and then we run something like custom-settings.ini. And we should see a lot of stuff. And in one of those, it's going to return the computer name because it's in the database. And the fastest way to find that.
You know you have Control F in Windows 10, right, in command prompts?
Yes.
Just checking.
What is the computer name? It's now set to PC004. And the reason is that it did do an SQL statement select star from where and all that, and it did return one object. So it did return one record, and that was the correct record. Now, so that's pretty easy to read from the database. And then you have someone that says, can't you use store procedure to update the database? Yeah, you can. Why would you do that? Well, I would like to do that. Okay, so let's open it up again. Go back to this guy and check the SQL Management Studio. Always run as administrator. What would life be without being an admin? So here's the database. Woo-ha-ha. And
didn't like you.
It didn't like me at all. That's weird. Why didn't it like me?
Would you like to have a database that works?
Don't be picky. I think it's in this database. You need to open it twice. It's a feature. Anyway, we go into the database and programmability and store procedures, and we're going to find that we do have store procedures. We have one called inventory computers with a bunch of parameters. This is actually something we use in production for a number of customers. In this case, we specify a lot of things that wasn't in the database from the beginning. And what the store procedure does is that if you, from custom-settings.ini, specify this store procedure, it's going to update the database with the correct information. So that means that, for instance, we could have something that says, well, if the computer is not known, then ask for the computer name. But if we installed it once, it's now recognized as that computer. So this one, it's really hard to run this, by the way. Let's go to the production control. I think I have a sample folder here. Yes, I have. And here we have something called custom setting update DB. So this is going to run default hardware info, alias user exit, and update DB in that order. So number one, it's going to use the following alias user exit, basically the same as the one that Johan showed you. And then we have others. So this is a hardwareinfo.vbs script. And before you start asking yourself, is it possible to run a PowerShell command inside a VB script? The answer is yes, you can. So if you really want to do a user exit script with PowerShell, then you go to Deployment Bunny and you search for user exit script together with PowerShell, and you're going to find how to do that. So we're going to grab all this information. And if I go back to this machine, which was here, and I remove the mini-empty folder, and we run this instead. I think I have it. So, there it is. custom settings update DB. We run that. Now it's going to gather information and feed it back to the database. So you can do whatever manipulation you want to do with the database from either side. So if we go back here to the database again, to MDT, and we do a refresh, and we go here, and now you can suddenly see that we have the asset tag, GUID number, serial number, and a MAC address, and if I go to details, you can suddenly see that it did an inventory of the machine. So now it knows number of CPUs, name of CPUs, drive, size. In this case, we have a filter that says don't inventory virtual network adapters. So no, it's not an asset management system, but it's an example of how you could feedback data to the database that could be used. For instance, which we do have a customer that is actively using, every time they deploy a machine, they specify that this was the date the machine was deployed. Okay? And then they also have another entry in the database, purchase date. And that means they can match those. So if the time period between we bought the machine and we deployed the machine is more than number of days, we're out of warranty. And the next time someone tries to deploy that or redeploy it or refresh it, it says, no, you're not allowed to do that. This machine is supposed to be garbaged or refurbished or whatever. So it is pretty easy to use the database for various reasons. We always get the question, shouldn't I pre-stage the machine in Active Directory or in Configuration Manager? It's much easier to have one entry point of all the data, or you need to grab all the other data, which you also can do. So assuming that we already have the data in place somewhere else, maybe it's already in an asset management system. The question is, can we reach that data? If you already have somewhere that says this MAC address is this name of the computer, should be having this following functions and roles, well, then we can reach out and ask for that data instead. And that's called?
I wasn't paying attention.
You never do. It's called web services. Using web services means that we already have the data somewhere, so I don't want to store it in the MDT database. I want to grab the data instead. And that's web services.
Yes. So, number 8, please.
I need to go to demo first.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I rushed ahead.
Mm-hmm. Don't do that.
Web services is just a very convenient way of having code running server-side that retrieves some information and spits it back to the inner file that the sequence in turn actually consumes. So for example, one customer I was working with, they were a config manager customer. They were using Active Directory groups as a way to assign application. It's quite common. So they have a collection in config manager, and a query on that collection is to populate it using an AD group with computers. So that's how they assigned applications. They had a collection name at OBreeder, they had a group name at OBreeder, and when they added a machine to that OBreeder group, eventually the collection figured that one out, and the app was installed. Now, they were also reinstalling machine, and they wanted the same apps to be installed again. Cool thing is, well, they already know what apps the machine had, because it was already a member of a bunch of groups in Active Directory that Helpdesk has been using for a while. So we put together a small web service that simply enumerated all AD groups and figured out what applications that machine was supposed to have. And instead of hard coding them in the sequence, we just had the web service generate a list of apps that the sequence then used. So just to give you an example, the default sequence in Config Manager, when you have it integrated with MDT, has an action, actually two actions.
Want some help?
No. One that installs legacy packages if you receive or feed it with a list, and one that installs application model applications. That's the default behavior of the sequence. If it gets a list, it will install them at that point in the sequence. So then we decided, why not simply give Active Directory all the information it needs to install the app? So if I go over to the main controller, let me reconnect to that guy using RDP. Thank you. And log in. Open Active Directory users and computers. So what we did, we have all the software groups we have in this OU. So again, there is a group for 7-Zip, Adobe Reader, and Skype. If I go to the 7-Zip group, properties, what we did, we borrowed, stole, with all the intention of returning it, a value that the customer didn't use, an attribute. The admin description. This is not the normal description. This is another attribute. And we simply tell it that, well, if you belong to this group, this is the package, the legacy package you're supposed to have if you belong to that group. Same thing we did for in this case, Skype. We added in app and the application name. So now the AD group has everything that Config Manager needs. Don't even need a collection. Don't even need a deployment. The sequence can just call the app directly. So we use the ini file. Have one here. It's very complicated to call a web service. First of all, it's very complicated to install them also. Because you right-click here, you add application, and you point it to a folder where you have it. Of course, you need to have someone code it for you, but you always find some idiot has done that for you.
I didn't do that. There's another mic.
Well, if you go CodePlex, you find a bunch of examples. My blog also have a bunch of examples, including this one that you can download. But you add them as a application, and then...
And if you do have an issue with creating the folders, we have a 3-day training on that. When we actually spend 3 days on creating a folder and some other things.
Of course. I didn't say anything. So, this is the code in the ini file to call a web service. You have to give it a name and a variable you want to send to it. So in this case, I just have a VB script that runs it. So if I want to list all the packages for PC number 2, and just to show you, PC number 2 is indeed a member of Skype, Adobe Reader, 7-Zip, but not from this test group. So, 3 apps. Go back and run the script. Here, I have one script to list packages. The script calls the web service, spits back the list of the 2 packages that this machine belongs to. Same thing for the other one. It will give me a list of the 1 app that this machine is a member of. So now you can see I have a script that calls a web service that returns a list. The only thing you need to do, go to your sequences, run the script before the actions that actually installs the apps. But this is something we use all the time. Michael was showing you the ini file before with the rules engine running in it. But for example, this guy here. Single sequence that behaves differently. In this case, I'm deploying it to different hardware. For the 8570, it's going to install Bluetooth app, application model app. For the 8540, it's going to install a legacy package with hotkeys. So again, being dynamic, I can simulate this, test this. It's pretty nice.
What we can see people are doing, or customers, is they don't start with this. They start instead of modifying the task sequence, right? So they open the task sequence, they go to a section of it, and they create hardware applications. And then they start creating all the conditions inside that sequence. And when it takes more than 2 minutes to open a task sequence, and it contains a couple of
hundreds of
lines of XML data, the only way to verify that it works is to deploy it, right? And that takes now, because you have a lot of applications, maybe 2 hours. So, well, of course we can work 24/7, but usually it's at least 9-hour work day.
And you can do other things with this as well. Something that I use quite frequently is something like this. This is an example where I took the light touch deployment wizard, but I use it together with Config Manager. So it prompts the technician with the have to type in a computer name, but it also have to select an OU from Active Directory. So this front end is actually asking a web service to real time give me a list of all OUs that are in a specific OU in Active Directory. I don't list them all. I don't list the main controllers, for example. But it gives you a list of OUs in real time, and then I'm querying Config Manager for a list of available sequences, which is pretty cool. Since SP1 of Config Manager, when you deploy a sequence to a collection, you have the option of saying hidden. When it's hidden, it's not normally displayed in the wizard. But if you have a script, or in this case a web service, you can enumerate them on the site server and request the sequence that is hidden. So you can have automation to say, oh, if I'm on this subnet, give me that sequence. Another subnet, give me that sequence. If it's raining, no sequences. You can do this. You can combine a light touch deployment when you start it, F12 and things. You get prompted with credentials. So you have to type in an Active Directory user. Config Manager doesn't have that. Config Manager has a password. You can borrow the authentication from light touch, and based on who logs in, he or she will be presented with different sequences. If they belong to a different site, they will see different sequences. If they are in the data center, they will see server-only sequences, and vice versa. So you don't accidentally deploy Windows 10 to a server, which may upset the data center folks.
And there are also actually publicly available web services. So you can query for things like zip code numbers or area code numbers and things like that.
There is a gentleman down in Germany, Mr. Mike Koster. He's an overachiever. He has written a few web services publicly available for Config Manager, for Active Directory, and a few other things. If I typed it correctly, yes, I did. So he divided them into 4 different sections. There's about 150 of them. But, for example, the Active Directory ones are fantastic. This, why not do this? You deploy a machine, in the end of the sequence, you call a function that adds the machine to a group of your liking. That could be a group that assigns wireless access or do some configuration. If you prompt for a user, wouldn't it be smart to kind of check if that computer exists? So that the technician cannot type in DZ01 and just replace your domain controller with another object?
We could have a VIP group of computers, and if the computer is a member of that group, you cannot override the computer name. However, if it's just a standard computer, then it's fine to assign the same name, because that is assuming you're doing a refresh or a replace or just reinstalling your machine.
This is something I use all the time. I was working with I'm going there in 4 weeks. Austin, Texas is a conference. Been working with them for a while. They're using Light Touch for deployment. And the fun thing about Light Touch is if you have a policy that pops up like a notification or renames the admin username, Light Touch is going to be upset and break. Because Light Touch, unlike Config Manager, is actually allowing policies to happen. Config Manager is suppressing them. So what you can do is to simply put all the machines into a staging OU during deployment, to which you have no policies. And then in the end of the sequence, you move that object into the right OU where you have all your fine policies, do a final GP update and a reboot, and then you're done.
For Windows 10, that one is especially important.
Yes.
Because we're doing refresh and we're doing in-place upgrade. Let's assume that you're doing an in-place upgrade of a Windows 7 machine. And it's in this OU. And we really need to move that to another OU so it gets other group policies. All that can be fixed in other ways, but it's kind of tricky. And I really had a customer say, well, I will remember to move them every time we deploy them.
Of course.
And I said, OK.
Last November, I was doing a Windows 10 deployment project in Stockholm. The customers were having, indeed, Windows 7. They were also using AppLocker quite heavily. So they had tightened down that system pretty hard.
And it was good. It was really secure.
It worked perfect for Windows 7. Now they started to introduce an upgrade to Windows 10, and they put the machines into the same collection. It turns out there are a few applications in Windows 10 that can be handy to have. Start menu and search, for example. They are applications in Windows 10, and they were blocked. And the users were having a hard time using Windows 10 without the start menu and search.
Let's say they couldn't do anything at all. But it was very secure. Nothing happened, right? So.
It was difficult even for a techie, I can tell you, to navigate around, figure out what happened.
It's true.
And it also corrupted the AppLocker policies on the box, of course. So I had to delete them as well from the folder.
Yeah, because if you just remove them, it's still corrupted. So you need to.
Yep. House cleaning.
Yeah.
So web services are extremely powerful. If you don't like to write them yourself, download them and use them.
There is another web services, if you go back. Not the Active Directory one. Instead, there's an MDT database, which is so weird. Why would we need to have a web services access to the MDT database? Can I use the network as usual?
I can demonstrate why. In Paint, this is a skill of mine.
It's called PowerPaint.
Yes. This is a site, two sites, connected with a link, a 4 megabit link that nobody can read what it says, but maybe now. So if you have a good network where we have latencies that rarely go above the, not super good, but it's not Starbucks either. It's somewhat OK. If you have this, and if you're using named pipes as a protocol, meaning you have a client down here. Whoops. So this is a client. And this is a config manager server that has a database. I told you I'm good. So when you deploy a client, it's going to reach over the network to this database directly using named pipes. And hopefully it will get something back. If you have a slow network, it's no longer 4 megabit. It's now 0.4 megabit. And we have latencies that on average starts to go like really, really high. This is not going to work. Guarantee you. Sure, you can increase the connection string timeout in the script. It will help you. Absolutely nothing. So instead, you add in purple circles here, two of them. This is your web service. So the client talks to the web service talks to the database, gets something back to the client, and hand it, well, get the data back to the client. So now we're switching protocols from named pipes into HTTP or HTTPS, depending what type of web service you're using. If you're just using a web service to read a computer name, I couldn't care less if somebody was able to see that over the network. Who cares? But if I'm using authentication, sending passwords to the Active Directory, maybe not HTTP.
No.
And now it actually starts to work, even on poor networks. If you can't get this web service to work, you cannot use Config Manager either, because Config Manager is also using web services.
So that's a cloud-based solution then, right?
Yes.
Right. It's important to say cloud. We've done that now.
Yes. So, I mean, before jumping over to the next demo, I mean, these web services, it's obviously code. You can code them in anything you like. I happen to like Visual Studio. Pick one of them. I have a bunch of them. Each web service is about 25 lines of code. And on the example that I have on CodePlex, I include the source code on the front end one. The reason is not maybe because all of you is going to go home and start coding things in Visual Studio. It's just that your security team can be hesitant if you tell them, hey, I found this cool DLL on the internet. I would like to add that to our site server. Can I do that? And they go, no. But then you can just give them the source code and say, this is it.
Now they're going to ask first what it's going to do. It's going to grab things in Active Directory. No.
So
that's not going to happen.
They can have someone review it. Look at it. If you have an experienced developer and give them this, first they will yell at you, but then we'll actually say this is no harm. It's just reading from AD. That's nothing else. So, yeah. But then, for those who don't like to code much in Visual Studio, there is a Lego version of web services. It's another System Center product.
Yes, and it's not called System Center Lego. It's called System Center something else. So we need to flip back.
This is important.
Yes, and then press down. And then we talk about orchestrator runbooks instead.
Both LightTouch and Config Manager can call runbooks during deployments.
Now, the interesting thing about orchestrator runbooks is that it is pretty easy to start with. And every time we do classes and we come to this point, and you can see people in the classroom going like, oh, this is going to be hard. I took one of those orchestrator classes like 2 years ago, and that was really complicated. Now, the most advanced runbooks you will ever create is something that looks like this. This is like playing with not Lego, it's more Lego Duplo. Like, you can be 3 years of age and go like, yeah, green, red fits, so great. Because that is the only thing we need to do. We need to do single tasks like move a computer from one OU to another, send an email, update a database, create an error condition, update the service manager, something like that. But rather than talking about this, it's much more fun to do demos, so it's demo time. I'm old, 9. So in this case, this is a really complicated runbook. This is actually the same thing as move computer. And the only thing you need to do when you create these things, it's very simple. Let's go to demo. New runbook. Check out. I'm checking it out.
Do you have a summit on that guy?
Of course I have. I don't know. Do I have summit? Not in the machine. Outside machine. Oops, sorry. I have it here.
I think it really helps if you have it in the VM.
Really?
Yes.
Maybe I have it in the VM. Maybe I have it in the tools folder. Maybe I have the summit thing. Maybe I added it to every image I ever create, because otherwise you're going to kick me in the legs when we do sessions, and that hurts.
Oh, no, I do this.
Yeah, I know. Now I can zoom.
Shiny.
Ouch. So we have another new runbook, and what we need to have is this funny thing that you have in the on the right side. And that is all the actions. Now, there's two ways of doing this. Either you've been playing with runbooks before, and then you know that, hey, I can do everything in PowerShell and just create the logic in runbooks. But in most cases, you're good enough with whatever you have in here. So in this case, I'm going to use the runbook control. And I'm going to grab what's called initialized data. And in initialized data, I add all the parameters I want to have, like the OSD computer name, for instance. I can't even type.
I'm sending you a message to your manager not to message you during the session.
Thank you. And maybe we want to have a serial number, because we need that information. We need that information because someone said, could you please create a comma-separated text file? And I said, yeah, of course I can do that. Why would you do that? Well, because our manager requires us to keep an updated list of every computer we ever deployed. How do you do that today? I sit down in Excel and type it. How many hours do you spend every week on doing that? About 20. Apply for another job. Which you can't tell him, but that's really what he was doing. So he asked, is it possible to do a comma-separated text file? And I said, yes, it is. And here comes the programming part. Ready?
Yes.
Programming. Thank you. I'm a developer now.
Yes, you are.
So you need to specify a text file. I'm going to grab the whatever text file. And you specify file encoding. And here's the other part of programming. We need to type something. So the customer says, OK, so I need a comma-separated text file. How do we create that? Well, if I go to subscribe and take variables, and I'm not doing subscribe publish data, I can grab the OSD computer name. Oh, that's great. And I'm going to expand that. But we also need to have the file comma separated, right? So you need to press comma. And then you add the other one, publish data, serial number. So if I run this runbook, it's going to create the text file with that name or update the text file for every deployment we do. So let's try that. That usually works. Runbook tester. Run. What was the computer name? Demo. 1, 2, 3, 4. Serial number is always 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That depends on what kind of vendor you buy the computer from.
There is a tweet coming in that says I should stop abusing the elderly on stage.
Whomever that was, thank you so much. So maybe we have, that was not the file. Oh, here it is, the Bob3 file. Yes, so it did type demo and it did type the serial number. And the guy was like, great, that's going to save me like 20 hours a week. And he was happy for, I don't know, 30 seconds. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to lose my job. So I said, no, you don't need to lose your job. What we can do is this. We can actually use SharePoint to update the list item. So I can connect this and say, hey, do stuff in SharePoint. Book a meeting. Order a pizza. And he was like, really? Can you do that? Yes, you can order a pizza as long as the pizza delivering system supports what's called a RESTful API web services, and most of them do. So as long as you can figure out how to order a pizza and put the credit card number in here, you can actually order a pizza for every machine you deploy, and book a meeting, and book a room, and then you're going to look busy for the rest of your life. What are you doing? I have a meeting with a pizza and a computer. That's great, because you can do all these things. Now, building these are pretty easy, and here is what we, for instance, do. Let's do OSD. here is a move computer to a collection. I want to, in the end of the deployment, move the machine to
add
a collection.
A computer.
Add, yeah, yeah, this move, sorry. Well, and here's the move computer to machine object OU. And here we have this fabulous send an email. All of these are really complicated runbooks. So the only thing you need to do is to have a license. Setting up an orchestrator server is easy. Now, if I have that and I can send an email, how many of you would like to have an email when you deploy machines? Some of you would like to have. It's nice, right? I'm deploying a couple of machines. Send me an email when they're done. Can I just have that? Yes, you can. Then you need to verify and test everything. So one of the things you'd really need to have is a mail server. And the mail server.
So you install quickly Exchange 2016,
exactly.
Right?
So here's the light version of Exchange 2016. It's a download. You run it and accepts any mail from anyone without any kind of authentication. It's marvelous. The only thing you need to do is open port 25. Yeah. That's it. It's the SMTP for dev. That way you can verify that it actually works before you start
installing Exchange.
Yeah, and asking the Exchange admin for everything you need to know. So I have that. And we need to play with this. And the way we play with this is this. We have
a sequence.
A sequence. It's a weird one. We have a sequence. And it doesn't matter if you run this in LightTouch or in Config Manager. It's going to work the same way. It looks the same way. The only reason I developed this in LightTouch is because it's faster. I'm lazy. If someone says, can we take a walk? Then my reply will be, aren't there any taxis, cars, buses, or can you carry me? I'm lazy. So I do it in LightTouch. Here's a test of the runbook. Idea is here to not do a complete deployment. So I just want to set some basic properties like the OSD computer name, the machine object OU, the email address. I don't want this machine to reboot. I'm going to gather information, and then I execute my runbooks. Now, adding a runbook is fairly easy. You specify execute orchestrator runbook. You specify the orchestrator server. You hit browse, and then you get whatever you want to have for runbook. And if I grab that, well, it's a customer that wants a asset management system to be updated. The asset management system is a guy that receives papers. So this prints the information so they can sign on it. That's what it does. So it does automatically receive all these variables that we have from the sequence. So that's the only way I need to do. I need to add it that way. So I already have this sequence. It's called RND01. And if we go to my Windows 10 OU, as you can see, there's only one machine here. And I want to verify
that the runbook works.
Yes. So I'm going to first of all make sure that I don't have the mini-NT folder. I remove it. And then I'm going to execute the LightTouch VB script. And this is like watching paint dry. So it's running through all the rules. And then I'm going to pick the task sequence. A lot of rules. Yeah. And then we go to dev. And then we go to test the runbook. And then we hit next. And then we begin. Now, the downside of using runbooks is that you can only use them inside the task sequence. And that is almost true, because if you go to my blog, you will find a PowerShell script that actually executes web services. So you can put that in a as a user action script if you want to.
And also the sequence in LightCat is actually us calling a script in the backend. You can run the same script if you like with the parameters.
The only trick with runbooks is that they are, it's not really the name you're accessing, it's the GUID number you're accessing. So you need to have a parser that does it for you. But that's basically, it's easy. So if we go to my orchestrator server, or we could go to my domain controller first. Here's my domain controller. We didn't receive an email yet, and it's still going to be in the same OU. Oh,
here's the email.
Here's the email. I can view that. And it says, it's from the OSD Superman at viamonster.com. It's a new guy we hired. And whatever name it was, and I can actually open it up by doing an inspect. You can then see the headers, the body, and you can attach log files to it if you want to. And if you go to Active Directory, Users and Computers, which I have here, viamonster, Windows 10, there it is. It has been moved. So now I know that those components work. The runbook is working as expected. Now I can put that in the real task sequence. And now I have an engine to move things. Now, there's another interesting thing. There's a connection to Service Manager. Maybe you deploy a machine using Configuration Manager, which has a really nice feature. It has an error out. If something goes wrong in the sequence, it's going to run the error section. Why don't you put a orchestrator runbook action that says create an entry in the service management database so we got logging on all the issues and errors we have, or something else like that. So there's a lot of things you can do.
So if you're interested in starting to do customizations through MDT and Config Manager, the book to the right, Stealing with Pride, it's not something you should not steal. That's not the point of the title. It's a metaphor for not reinventing the wheel. This book comes with tons of sample files. Most of, we have shown some of it here, and there are other stuff. But it takes you through how to be a little bit more of a developer as an IT pro. Start to actually write some more scripts and codes and source versioning and things like that to get the customizations going.
Wasn't there a guy that had a book on his desk and his boss came by and said, why do you have a book saying Stealing with Pride? What are you doing?
With a pirate ship on
it. Yeah, with a pirate ship on it. Like, are you doing something really bad that you shouldn't do? No, it's a really good book.
On this website, we have gathered resources for further testing, labbing, things, whatever you need to do. We will also blog, put out the blog post from this session where we put all the links. We have them available. And with that, we'd like to thank you for spending the time with us this afternoon. Have a great conference.
Thank you.